21st Century Radio is sponsored by Hieronymus and Company. This is Talk Radio 680 WCBM. It's time now for award-winning 21st Century Radio. Here's your host, Dr. Bob Hieronymus.
Just one key unlocks them both. It's there at your command. Come on, people now. Smile on your brother. Everybody get together. Try to love one another right now.
Welcome back to 21st Century Radio. I'm your host, Dr. Bob Hieronymus, and of course, our executive producer and research assistant, Laura Kortner. And our engineer is Anita Brockington. Tonight's guest is Stephen Sora, and we will be reviewing his new book, Rosicrucian America, How a Secret Society Influenced the Destiny of a Nation. From Avalon in Newfoundland to New England to Pennsylvania and Virginia, Sora shows how Sir Francis Bacon and Dr. John Dee, Rosicrucian, the impact is felt throughout America. He details Bacon's possible authorship of the anonymous Rosicrucian texts of the early 1600s and his connection with Sir Walter Raleigh's School of Knight and the origins of Rosicrucianism in Sir Francis Bacon's Order of the Helmet. He explains how Bacon envisioned America as the New Atlantis, a utopia where liberty and freedom of learning prevailed, a key tenet of the Invisible College of the Rosicrucian Order, and how Dee convinced the Queen that England had a rightful claim in the New World by drawing on legends of both King Arthur and the Welsh Prince Madoc, voyaging to West America. Stephen Sora has been researching historical enigmas since 1982 and is the author of several books, including The Lost Treasure of the Knights Templar and Secret Societies of America's Elite. He was featured in the History Channel movie Holy Grail in America and on TV show America Unearthed on History Channel 2. He lives in Easton, Pennsylvania. Now, this is Steve's fourth time joining us on 21st Century Radio, but the last time he joined us was in 2003. That was 16 years ago. Whoa. Welcome back to 21st Century Radio, Steve.
Thank you, Dr. Bob. Laura was just saying to me, I think 13 years, and I'm saying, no, it can't be that long.
No, well, it was 16. 16 years.
Wow.
Where have you been?
Well, this last book that I finished, it was like 7 years in the works.
Oh, yeah. Well, I don't know how you did in 7 years, because, you know, as you know, I'm interested in every one of those topics that's within the book. And, my gosh, you in such great detail. This is a super book. This is one of the most important books I've ever read. Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Let's see. Here we go. Let's begin with, what is the evidence of a small circle of elite English gentlemen having written the works of Shakespeare?
There's a handful of things. Bacon, I think, wrote the histories, and I think some of the others were works that were derived from Marlowe. Some of them were copies of Italian texts, and the evidence is they all... It was basically two groups that, you know, defended each other and helped each other with their works and their plays. At the time, writing a play didn't make any money, and it was kind of a negative to be a part of the stage. So, but these men all around the court of Elizabeth kind of banded together and just protected each other.
Well, you note that possibly the greatest of these individuals was the Englishman Sir Francis Bacon, 1561 to 1626. Why?
Well, what's really interesting in the book, and I know people consider this kind of speculative, but Sir Francis Bacon was actually the product of a marriage between Elizabeth and Robert Dudley. Robert Dudley and her were both born under a shadow of treason, and they were both in the London Tower for a long time. They both shared the same tutor, and they planned on getting married. And Robert Dudley at first had married this woman named Amy Robsart, but the Queen wanted to get rid of her, and she thought she could get away with marrying Dudley. So Amy fell down a staircase of stone, died, and the Queen made a joke out of it, and then they secretly got married in the end of the year, and in the beginning of the year, Bacon was born. But then they found out there was such backlash, especially from Catholic Spain, that if they announced the wedding, that they would have a lot of trouble. So they just kept it a secret. And Bacon always resented it. He made jokes of the name Bacon. He had things like Little Ham was Hamlet. Bermuda has hog pennies, and so on. There's a few of them that he kind of clowned around with, that this wasn't his real name. But even when he got married later on, he got married in purple, which was only reserved for royalty. And so there's a lot of evidence in one chapter of the book about what happened. Queen Elizabeth went as far as having people arrested and imprisoned for making any comment that she had a child.
Well, you know, all this material I've been looking at for like almost 50 years. And as I earlier said, you have done a terrific job of pulling it all together. And especially when we get to one of my favorite people in the whole wide world is Dr. John Dee. And you note that state that Dr. John Dee was also possibly the most influential man in Bacon's life. How so?
I think he was the one that had kind of pioneered a lot of this territory. He convinced the Queen and probably Bacon that the King Arthur actually came to the New World, and Avalon in Newfoundland is one of the little hints at that. Madoc the Prince came from Wales, where Arthur also came from, and settled colonies either on the Mississippi or much further north. And so this kind of established a right for the Queen to take possession of the New World. He also convinced her that with the money that they had from one raid on the Spanish, he convinced her that they have create the biggest navy they could, and they had the concept of the sun never setting on English territory.
Did you hear rumors about anything about this thing concerning who wrote Shakespeare many, many decades ago, and it eventually evolved to the point where you just had to dig deeper and deeper, that 7 years that you put in?
Yeah, that was a big part of what I was doing, and thanks to YouTube and other things, there's a lot of work and documentaries that can be had for free, so while I'm doing my day job, I can sit there and watch a documentary, which helped. And there was even one woman, Mary of Pembroke, that she gets credit for one of the Shakespeare works.
Hey, that's good. you know, I think it's going to be very difficult for people to accept the fact that Shakespeare, which we're going to get into him deeply later on, could most people have just accepted that he wrote all these works. When did you begin to doubting that?
I think I read a book by Donnelly that started that. But, I mean, some of the evidence is so blaring that it's hard to just, you know, dismiss it. For one, Bacon was born in St. Albans, and the works of Shakespeare, St. Albans, is mentioned 23 times. Shakespeare was born in Stratford, and that's never mentioned. Shakespeare couldn't read or write. There's no evidence that he could. I think he had four signatures in his lifetime that were all different. There's a line in the text attributed to Shakespeare that says, "A man that loved his books, he didn't have any." There was practically none in the town. He didn't own any of the plays or have any writing at all. His parents were illiterate. His daughter was illiterate. And I think there was something like 15 counselors in the town, and half of them were illiterate. So it's kind of remarkable to attribute one of the best works in history to a man that couldn't write.
Yes, he has what we have, six or eight signatures, and they're not all the same.
Right.
That's what immediately, when I learned that about 40 years ago, I thought, my God, that's not possible. How in the world could he write without knowing, write the plays without actually knowing how to write? It doesn't make any sense, and I'm amazed that this has not made it to any major news story, in a sense. It just seems like it's totally taboo for anyone to talk about it.
I have a cousin that teaches English on the college level, and he just, oh, that's a load of crap.
Yeah, of course they're going to say that. Of course. But, you know, when researchers get into studying the lives, and in your book you have many researchers going into his life and checking out that and finding out that he could not read, he could not write, he owned no books, and when he died he had nothing to give to anybody except a secondhand bed and other
right.
couple of things. And so that's why I am just amazed that this fella just keeps on going. Obviously, a lot of people, when they get tied into this, just seem to love Mr. Shakespeare so deeply that they won't even listen to this. It's kind of like the stories of UFOs, in which this has been repeated many times, that there have been a group of scientists in one particular building, and another group of individuals see a UFO on the outside, and they tell everyone there's a UFO out here. And of course, what happens is nobody goes out to see it because they don't believe it. It's the same. This is the same kind of story that went on with Mr. Whoever he is. What was his real name?
Excuse me.
What was Shakespeare's real name?
I'm pretty sure it was Will Shakespeare.
Wasn't there two?
One of the people that did a lot of work with it was a guy named Henry Wriothesley. He was the third Earl of Southampton. He was a member of the court, but he was teased that he never went to the court. He went to plays every day. And he was the one that bought the text from Shakespeare. Shakespeare was given enough money to buy a house back in Stratford. And so I would think he is the next person to get the most credit.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's go back here just a second on the question of Sir Francis Bacon, and you mentioned that he was the son of Elizabeth I, the Queen of England.
Right.
When was can you recall the very first time you heard that? And did you believe it at that time?
I would say 3 or 4 years ago, and I knew that a lot of checking had to be done in that, and I have like a half a bookcase of Shakespeare books, and it was mentioned by other people as well, and with references to, say, someone named Anne Dowd being arrested for mentioning it and all, and so it's believable then. It's another one of those things, though, that people are going to say, oh, you know, get out of here.
Right, of course. Of course. I've been through that all my life. And I think any researcher goes through that all the time because there's so much. Oh, we are going to have to take a break for the very first time here on 21st Century Radio. Rosicrucian America, How a Secret Society Influenced the Destiny of a Nation, Destiny Books. By the way, friends, this is one of the best books I have ever read. It's not just, it's a great book. You've got to get a copy. Available at Amazon and Barnes & Noble, as well as innertraditions.com. All links are at 21st Century Radio and ZoharaOnline.com. Don't forget our archives are also posted weekly for free iTunes and our YouTube channel. You know what I was surprised to learn when studying the Statue of Liberty? That liberty for real women is the key to humanity's survival on this planet. Truly. And also that Lady Liberty has Native American roots, and that America has reverence for the female half of divinity, or the goddess, at its very foundation. Powerful women and role models for balance are all part of our new book, The Secret Life of Lady Liberty, Goddess in the New World. It's a new way to understand America's history and future. Buy your copy today at Amazon.com or Barnes & Noble, or from our website, SecretLifeOfLadyLiberty.com. That's SecretLifeOfLadyLiberty.com, just chock full of all new reasons to love the United States of America.
I'm Joe Sobrin, author of Alias Shakespeare, and you're listening to Dr. Bob Hieronymus on 21st Century Radio.
As our listeners probably know, we've done many shows dealing with Shakespeare and this particular problem, but never about pulling it into the Rosicrucians, etc. Our guest, of course, is Stephen Sorrow, Rosicrucian America, How a Secret Society Influenced the Destiny of a Nation, Destiny Books. Is it true that Francis Bacon founded the Rosy Cross while in school?
First thing he founded was a group called the Knights of Pallas Athena. And Pallas Athena was said to be invisible when she put on her helmet. And so they called themselves the Invisibles. Then one part of the Invisibles became the Rosy Cross. And he is the one that founded it. He kind of understood the need for secrecy, and so he did a lot of writing that nobody ever was able to see when he was alive.
Could you repeat that, please, the last sentence?
He founded a little group called the Knights of Pallas Athena, and Pallas Athena was a goddess that when she put her helmet on, she was invisible to the world. So it was said that these were like the knights of the helmet because they could also make themselves the Invisibles, which was a nickname for the Rosy Cross later. Out of this group, he formed the first Rosicrucian order. And behind the scenes, him and Dr. D wrote The Phantom of Fraternius and the other book that, basically started Rosicrucianism.
How were the Rosicrucians even more secretive than the Freemasons?
For the longest time, until probably modern days, they never allowed a membership list. And so there'd be a lot of people that would write about how great the Rosicrucians were as far as matters of science and things like that. But at the same time, they would all deny that they were in the order. Whereas Freemasons, we still have records going back hundreds of years as far as who went to lodge meetings and things like that.
Well, a handful of men connected to Dr. John Dee and Sir Francis Bacon called themselves the Invisibles. And you mentioned, of course, the Invisibles before about the helmet. Is this because the Rosicrucians were regarded as invisible?
I think the theme was based on Pallas Athena. But they actually had a meeting in Paris, and they put up all these signs that the meeting, anyone that wanted to join the Invisibles to meet at this one place, nobody showed up, and so they said that's because they were all invisible.
Whoa, boy. Whoa, yes. Now, one of the people that I've greatly admired, I loved what you had to say about William Penn. Why did William Penn invite Rosicrucians to Philadelphia?
He was one of the people that didn't come to America for the gold or anything else. He came to start a land that would be based on the New Atlantis of Bacon, that anybody could study whatever they want. They could be free to exercise whatever religion they want or don't want. And he thought this would be one place. He also invited a handful of Protestant orders that they were sometimes plagued by the Habsburgs in Europe, so we invited them to come to Pennsylvania.
Why would he want them to come?
Because they would populate his colony that, you know, would be based on these principles of free thinking.
I'm trying to recall the name of that particular colony. It's slipping my mind.
The name of what?
That colony. What was it originally called?
I think it was just, they called it Penn's Woods because he had this giant walking plot that he had hired people to walk as far as they could, and whatever they got from the Native Americans. He also was given a lot of property from the King of England at the time, who owed his father. So there was no specific colony that represented anything different.
Oh.
They had little colonies, like there's a creek called the Wissahickon in Philadelphia.
Oh, well,
and
yes.
So they called them the Hermits of the Wissahickon. And this was just one sect, but a guy named Kelpius ran it, and they lived in caves there.
Oh, that was one of the greatest joys of my life, going up there and seeing those caves.
I was told that I'd never be able to find it. I parked my car, and there's someone on a mountain bike, and I say, "Do you know where the Kelpius cave is?" And he says, "He'll drive around, and when I see him, wave to me. It's there." Had no problem at all.
Oh, wow. Now, what secret messages did Jules Verne, Ian Fleming, and Daniel Defoe place in their writings hinting at the Rosicrucians?
Fleming's mother, her last name was Rosie Cross. He had a lot of characters that the names would start with R.C., and a lot of Rosicrucian themes. A lot of times a woman exercising her mental ability a lot more than even James Bond. And so a theme that was based on not, you know, just male sexism. Jules Verne, he had characters that also had R.C. names. I think he had Phineas Fogg, which one of the groups of Invisibles called themselves the Fogg. So Phineas Fogg represented that. That was, I think, in Around the World in 80 Days. And Robinson Crusoe was really interesting because the first page of the book says that my family's name really means Rosie Cross, but we anglicized it from the German.
Oh, I see. I want to go back to the Order of the Helmet. Tell us a little bit more about the Order of the Helmet and what that was about.
Well, I think it was a group of people that would become Rosicrucians. They would be in, you know, different studies. At the time, people could get executed for studying blood and how it's pumped. They could get executed for a whole bunch of things. So these were done in secret. So in other words, their work was invisible to the outside world.
Mm-hmm. Well, I can that's obvious. The thing that I was concerned about that helmet was when we got into writing our last book dealing with the goddesses, etc., I was particularly trying to think exactly which goddess is related to that helmet.
Pallas Athena.
Pallas Athena, right.
And I think, if I remember, and I should, I think she's in the Odyssey, too. I think she's secretly arranging troubles for Ulysses. And, like, she'll be on the ship, and then all of a sudden she'll put the helmet on, and no one can see that she's on the ship.
Yeah. That'd be nice to have every now and then. That, you know, I've always had some difficulty at times with the research of Manly Palmer Hall, who I love a great deal, and his I quoted him many times. But some of his research I found lacking, but one that I was very interested in was, how was Manly Palmer Hall's one-world government different from Sir Francis Bacon's utopian world?
I if anything, it was that it was, you know, one world, and that it was kind of run with authority rather than run with, you know, maybe disorder, just freedom of thought, freedom of action.
And Bacon's world, utopian world?
Right, Bacon. People that were invisibles or Rosicrucians, they could study anything they want. If they didn't agree with somebody else's, there wouldn't be any need to fight that person or ban that person.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the difference in New Atlantis.
The New Atlantis. One of the things that I've always been fascinated with, and I'm sure you have been as well, is Dr. John Dee's Monus Hieroglyphica. This is a very complicated issue, but what is the importance of Dr. John Dee's Monus Hieroglyphica?
Sorry to say, but I really don't know. And I just got back from Newport, where a person named James Egan runs a museum at the Newport Tower, and he explains it, but not really a satisfactory explanation.
Well, I can understand that, because it's I know, we all know that when you take a look at it, and obviously, since we're on radio now, it's hard to describe. But as a matter of fact, maybe we better not talk about that aspect of it, because it is very hard to describe this particular thing. But I've always been fascinated by it, and I think that it has something, of course, to do with it's related. It's so special to John Dee that I think that he was obviously the person who put it together for some alchemical reason, because alchemy basically is, of course, what the Rosicrucians and other secret societies have were emphasizing. Could you talk a little bit about alchemy to us?
Well, basically, alchemy turned into a bad word. Once upon a time, it would have been chemistry. And so today, if someone's trying to invent a new gas or something like that, no one would have any interest in stopping them. Back then, it was considered, I guess, against the Catholic Church, for one. And so as a result of that, you know, it was banned.
Well, as Queen Elizabeth, there were a number of things about Queen Elizabeth. I had no idea she was the kind of person that she was. Of course, I've read books on her and things of that nature, but you get right to the point from the standpoint of not only, of course, did she marry, have a child, was the queen, but how she was the queen and how she held on to being the queen. Could you talk to us a little bit about that?
Well,
she had some tough times.
And the people in England were afraid that if she married someone in Spain, she'd become a Catholic, and they would have to become Catholic. The people in Spain were afraid that if she married within her own religion, then that would make England stronger, and so it would be a threat to Spain. So she had like a council of men that would pretty much decide what she could do, and would protest and influence her as far as when she talked about making a decision.
She obviously, would you say she's did a few things that were illegal?
Very possibly. She was probably the first most educated woman in England, and there's only a few people that are mentioned as being as well-read, as well-adopted to sports and things like that as Elizabeth is. And but still, she had that kind of balance. She, on I think it was September 8th, 1560, the woman Amy Robsart fell down the stairs and died. It was 4 days later, September 12th, 1560, that she married Robert Dudley. So they may not have planned the murder, but they had plans all along that if he could get remarried, it'd be to her. And then, as interesting as that, January 22nd of 1561, this is like 4 months later, Bacon was born. And so it was like she was been probably 5 months pregnant when she knew she was going to have another child. So Amy was definitely in the way. But then everything went wrong. She became the mother of Bacon, but on the surface, Nicholas Brown was the mother, and Anne Bacon would be, I mean, Nicholas Brown was the father, and Anne Bacon was the mother. Nicholas died in 1579, and he left stuff for all of his children except Francis Bacon, because I think he understood that Bacon wouldn't have the need for money.
Yeah, I was quite interested in Bacon's use of purple. You mentioned from the very beginning of the interview here that he wore it. He's not, you know, he wasn't allowed to wear it, but he did because he knew obviously he was indeed born to be a king. Later on, which had never happened, of course, didn't happen that way. We need to take a break here on 21st Century Radio. And when we come back, let's talk a little bit about John Dee in regards to being the astrologer of Queen Elizabeth and what kind of advice did he give her from that standpoint. With our guest Stephen Sora, Rosicrucian America, how a secret society influenced the destiny of a nation. Destiny Books. It's available at Amazon and Barnes & Noble, as well as InnerTraditions.com. Ah, what nice little music we have here. How would you like to win a free copy of the book that we are talking about tonight? Rosicrucian America, How a Secret Society Influenced the Destiny of a Nation by Stephen Sora, Destiny Books. If you know the answer to this hour's trivia question, you will win that. And all you have to do is please tell us who was my guest the last time I hosted 21st Century Radio. Now, you can do that. If you can do that, you'll win this book. But you got to qualify, and here's how to do it. If you know the answer to this hour's quiz question on 21st Century Radio and you have not won from us in the last 60 days, call in now. 410-922-6680. That's 410-WCVM-680. First with the right answer wins. Prizes are available for you to pick up at the WCBM studios in Pikesville after Friday of this week. Winners have 60 days to pick up the prizes and must wait 60 days before winning another prize from 21st Century Radio. Good luck.
Hi, I'm Glenn Kreisberg, author of Spirits in Stone and co-founder of the Overlook Mountain Center in Woodstock, New York, overlookmountain.org. And you're listening to 21st Century Radio with Dr. Bob Hieronymus. Keep listening.
Now, behind our last, not our guest, but last announcer there, was Philip Glass. Philip Glass. I don't know if you read the New York Times today, but Akhenaten. Do you remember Akhenaten? Well, the last week of this classic trilogy by Philip Glass is going to be at the Met. So we're bound to hear a lot more about Akhenaten than ever before. And in the late 70s, Dr. Zoe and I had the privilege of spending a little time with Anwar el-Sadat. And I'm very proud to say that he had in his possession my brand new doctoral thesis that dealt with America's pyramid and Eye in a Triangle. He had a major interest in the pyramid and the Eye in a Triangle, and we talked about that. We had the joy of our life of also giving the doctor in charge of the Akhenaten Temple Project at that particular time. I think it was a check from Mary Milholland, who an Egyptologist, a dear friend of mine, We gave them a check for over $30,000 for that particular. So that's whenever I hear Akhenaten, I'm very amazed that so many other people have picked up some of the history and stories that they're telling on history radio and evidence. And basically, they're saying, by and large, that there's some alien involvement there because of the shape of his head, etc. There might be something to that. Let's get back to our guest here, Stephen Sora. Are you familiar with Akhenaten?
With who?
Akhenaten.
No.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. He at one time was a pharaoh in Egypt, but you wouldn't have called him a pharaoh.
Oh, okay. No, I'm not really familiar, but I know the name.
Well, it was, as a matter of fact, it was on March 6th, 1988, that we had that particular tune talked about with Akhenaten, etc. Well, okay, let's go back to this most important problem that I had. Do you remember what it was?
You were asking about Dr. D and his influence on the Queen, and he at one time was an alchemist to the Queen. He was an astrologist, and part of the Monus represents the different elements, the sun and the moon, and Aries, the zodiac that signifies the spring. She asked him to explain it to him, but I never showed an answer to it. He also believed in sailing to America for the different reasons. He came up with a person named Nicholas of Lynn, Lynn, England, who had a case for sailing to America maybe multiple times. And he was one of the first to then start a colony in the New World. The what is now the Narragansett Bay in Rhode Island was called the John D. River. So it's he had a lot to do with her. He predicted what the best time for her to get take the throne. So she did depend on him a lot.
She was, in some ways, a protector of him.
Yes, she was, because he was pretty much out of favor with a lot of people. At one time, he had to flee to Europe to stay for a while. He was accused of being a magician. When he was in college, he had put on a play, and he had a scarab that elevated itself on the stage, which amazed a lot of people but scared a lot of people at the same time. So, and then he was the teacher of some of the royal people around the throne, of their children. So he wasn't always in favor.
Well, I think I want to switch to the printing press used by Benjamin Franklin, who is a dear friend of mine. Well, not a dear friend. Was located in the Rosicrucian enclave in central Pennsylvania. What is the connection between that printing press and Ben Franklin and the Rosicrucian enclave in Pennsylvania?
I think the Germans and the Kelpius group and the group that settled in the middle of Pennsylvania, I think they were all far advanced as far as printing materials in Europe, and so they brought that over here, and somehow Bacon met him. Franklin met him. Franklin was of course from Philadelphia, and used them to print things for him, and then they also used it to print things for the new government. The place Ephrata in central Pennsylvania is still there, and it's pretty amazing.
Was Franklin a Rosicrucian?
Again, it's one of those people that probably was, because he was a free thinker. But because there's no membership or anything, it's hard to say. People believe Jefferson was, Paine was, a handful of people that formed the early government were Rosicrucians. It's just that they didn't really talk about it much. You mentioned Manly Hall. In Williamsburg, which was once the capital of Pennsylvania, there's a church, and all the names that are on the different pews in that church are different people that are connected to the movement for independence, and the movement for independence would definitely be a Rosicrucian ideal.
Were you referring to the Bruton Parish?
Yes.
Oh, gosh, yes. You've been there, I guess, huh?
Yes.
Well, last time we were there, we were with my daughter, and she gave us a fit. It was the wrong place to take our daughter. But at least she knew a little bit about that. Bruton Parish. Can you tell us anything about Bruton Parish?
Well, there is a church there, and the Bruton Parish Church may be over a secret vault that either holds treasures or something, or possibly original writings of Sir Francis Bacon. Mm-hmm. And people tried to dig it up a couple times. Then they moved the church, and so now no one's sure exactly where it is. But a group of people, they call themselves the Seven Sages of Sir Francis Bacon. Ooh. They were the last ones to try and almost got themselves arrested. And then I think it was like the 40s, the Rockefellers bought all that land. And so they basically are the only ones that can say what's there or lead an excavation to find out what's there. Yeah. Bacon had two people that were like work for him. One was his chaplain, another one was like his secretary. And after he died, one or both of them came to America and supposedly to hide some of his text, which he says the truth will out, but they didn't want to, you know, bring it out just yet. So a lot of people think that's what's in the Bruton Vault. There's also people that think that it's buried in Oak Island in Nova Scotia, which another expedition's going on. I think the text that Raleigh brought over was talking about the use of mercury as a way to protect documents in bottles for a long time. And when they first started digging up Oak Island, they found lots of mercury, and so they think that that, you know, could be where Bacon's texts were.
Well, that's always fascinating, that particular area, as to whether or not there really is gold buried there or is there information of some sort. But you've spent a lot of time on that particular area, haven't you?
Yes.
And what is your conclusion as to what might be buried there?
There's a lot of choices, but I would believe that it would be some kind of monetary treasure like gold or silver and documents. I don't really subscribe to like the Holy Grail or something like that. I think the Holy Grail's in Spain, and I think that people went out of their way quite a bit to bury these things.
You say the Holy Grail is in Spain? Can you tell us any more about that?
The Holy Grail is the cup that Jesus drank out of his Last Supper, and one bishop took that and headed towards Spain. The Roman Emperor arrested him, and he said that he'd return to them the Holy Grail, on the most sacred object in Christianity. And the next day, he was with a bunch of beraggled people, and so St. Lawrence said, he says, "Where's the Holy Grail?" St. Lawrence answered, "This is the most sacred thing in the church, the people." And then they executed him. But the chalice is in, I forget what city in Spain, but that's the last I read of that.
I'm sorry I laughed there, but, you know, I was thinking a little bit more about Queen Elizabeth and how many people she executed for talking out of turn or something. I mean, that I found that amazing. I guess it sounds a little bit like our president today from that standpoint, getting rid of, whatever. A secret organization had at its core the inner sanctum made up of Rosicrucians. What role did it play at the end of the war?
At the end of the war, there were people that didn't really want to say the Confederate cause was done with. And they formed a group, the Knights of the Golden Circle, and they were supposed to be from, like, Pennsylvania, Ohio, and ringing around down to Mexico and the Caribbean. And so they this Knights of the Golden Circle hid a lot of money that hadn't been taken by the North in different places in the United States. But the board, they did have a group of people that were considered their leaders, was made up, the majority were Rosicrucians.
Oh, whoa, wow. I didn't know that. Well, there's a lot of things I didn't know that I learned from your book from that standpoint.
Well, the Knights of the Golden Circle are really interesting because one of the members was Jesse James. And for all the banks him and his brother and their gang raided, no one really had a lot of wealth. It was all gone. So a lot of people think they have stashes in the South that are still protected, that are made up of gold and silver. So I don't know if the South will ever rise again, but I guess there are people that believe it could.
Well, if it rose again, let's just hope it rises as a democracy and not what it how it's controlled now in comparison to. You compare the South, especially in New Orleans and elsewhere, they're all in terrible situation from the standpoint of the floods that are coming. And we all know that. Now, Trump has just moved himself down to Florida. That has to be a huge mistake because it's going to be flooded out many times over, and they're going to lose the tip of Florida from that standpoint. So he shouldn't have done that. But what do I can't do anything about that. We'll return with our guest, Stephen Sora. The book is Rosicrucian America, How a Secret Society Influenced the Destiny of a Nation, Destiny Books.
For the king.
Stay connected with stimulating talk and breaking news on Talk Radio 680 WCBM, Baltimore, and WCBM.com.